Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 393, titled Love Means Never Having to Say You're Saudi. This is being recorded on January 5th of 2002, and a tip of the hat on the bad pun in the title to an editorial cartoonist whose name I can't remember, but who used that as the caption in an editorial cartoon in 2002. Actually, this is January 5th of 2003. Excuse me, I'm a year behind. This broadcast, as the title indicates, is going to update a number of different stories having to do with September 11th and some of the very powerful Saudi money connections. Bear in mind that at this point, for all intents and purposes, the entire For the Record program, the entire For the Record series, is available from sister station WFMU for free online on Real Audio. More recent shows streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. Older shows available for download only at a longer URL connected not only to the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website, but also to the For the Record section of the Real Audio-equipped Spitfire website, which has detailed, annotated, article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs available in the For the Record section. The description for the Record 393 will be available within a week of the recording of this broadcast. The first article here is from the Austin American Statesman, and research credit on this goes to a member of the listening audience. This is from the Austin American Statesman of Monday, December 2nd of 2002. This article is going to introduce a concept that I think is applicable not only to Al-Qaeda, but which is the context in which it's presented, but also to the concept that I've presented so many times and that may be very puzzling to listeners, and that is the concept of the Underground Reich, literally a Third Reich gone underground at the end of World War II and perpetuating itself in a very effective and deadly underground fashion using tremendous economic and political power. Like Al-Qaeda, the Underground Reich is a virtual state. Austin American Statesman, 12-2-2002, Sharon Jason of the Austin American Statesman staff wrote this article about Professor Philip Bobbitt of the University of Texas. It's called UT Professor Has Finger on Pulse of Warfare. It reads in part, University of Texas law professor Philip Bobbitt spent 10 years working on a book published this year that is proving eerily prescient. The Shield of Achilles, War, Peace, and the Course of History, is a daunting 919 pages about the transformation of war. It's filled with political theory, it's laced with portraits of key diplomatic figures, it's pages upon pages that discuss the differences between what he terms the nation-state and the market-state, and the emergence of the virtual state, represented by Al-Qaeda as an enemy organization without a definable location. His book was already at the publisher before the September 11th terrorist attacks, so Bobbitt added a post-attack epilogue. Now, again, key to this article for our purposes here, the concept of the virtual state, which Philip Bobbitt applies to Al-Qaeda, and he calls it represented by Al-Qaeda as an enemy organization without a definable location. That applies in a very direct fashion to the concept of the Underground Reich, although geographical center could be said, or epicenter would be a better way of putting it, could be said to be Germany, in fact, because of its tremendous economic power and the Nazi diaspora at the end of World War II. The Underground Reich is a virtual state and does not have definable boundaries, and as I've indicated so often, I believe the Underground Reich is behind not only the September 11th attacks, but a coordinated political and economic attack on the United States with the goal of either destroying or subjugating the United States. And again, many of the other programs about September 11th go into that. In keeping not only with the Saudi links to September 11th, obviously the title focal point of the broadcast, but also keeping in mind the concept of the Underground Reich and the very important German connections to September 11th that I've spoken about, note the following article. Some of the other broadcasts dealing with the German connections to September 11th, For the Record 326, 331, 336, and 343, among other shows. This is from the New York Times of Tuesday, December 24th of 2002, and it deals with the very really a stunning departure of a key al-Qaeda suspect from Germany without apparently any interference or attempted interference by German officials, this despite the fact that he would appear, as they say, to have been telegraphing his punches. Of course, it's also possible that there is intelligence monitoring of him, that perhaps he's being used as a dangle. But in light of the other aspects of the German/September 11th connections, including the fact that the cell in Hamburg, Germany, that was the epicenter for the planning of the attack was under physical surveillance, and in light of attempts by Germany to deflect blame and responsibility to elements of U.S. intelligence, which are also guilty of some very shoddy functioning in connection with September 11th. The following article is stunning, and again, not only al-Qaeda, but also the concept of the Underground Reich as a virtual state. Again, New York Times of Tuesday, December 24th of 2002, article by Desmond Butler, Dateline Berlin, headlined, "Terror Suspect's Departure from Germany Raises Concern in Other Nations." A German man under investigation for links to top figures of al-Qaeda slipped out of the country last month, withdrawing his 4 children from school, terminating his lease, and obtaining visas for Saudi Arabia without attracting any attention from the police, according to German officials. Christian Ganscharski, 36, a Polish immigrant who until recently lived in the western German city of Mülheim, had been under investigation since the German police overheard a telephone call from Nizar Nawar shortly before Mr. Nawar detonated a bomb on April 11th in front of the Griba Synagogue on the Tunisian island of Djerba. The blast killed 21 people, including 14 German tourists. Prosecutors overseeing the investigation say that under German law, the evidence tying Mr. Ganscharski to the bombing and his own confession of recent contact with Qaeda leaders were insufficient to keep him under constant surveillance or to prevent him from traveling. They say those limitations are the consequence of a constitution devised to prevent the reoccurrence of the country's totalitarian past. The case has caused concern among officials in France and Tunisia involved in an investigation into the Djerba bombing and illustrates the complexities of fighting a global network like al-Qaeda. Last week, the Tunisian justice minister complained openly about Mr. Ganscharski's departure. Quote, "Investigations into the attack on Djerba have moved forward very well, and I hope that the flight from Germany of an accomplice of the suspected perpetrator of the attack will not hamper inquiries," the minister Bashir Takhari told Agence France-Presse. In addition to Tunisian officials, French officials have been very upset as well. In a recent interview, a high-ranking French official who insisted on anonymity expressed frustration that Mr. Ganscharski had not been detained. Under French law, the official said, he would have been, unquote. Mr. Ganscharski is a figure whom German prosecutors say may have been able to provide unique knowledge of Qaeda cells. Under interrogation, he has admitted to traveling 5 times to Qaeda camps in Afghanistan, including once about a month after the September 11th attacks. Quote, "This suspect stands out from all others because he has had contact with the inner circles of al-Qaeda," unquote, said K. Naim, NEHM, Germany's chief federal prosecutor in a recent interview. Again quoting, "We do not find such a witness every day. He is someone who knows a lot," unquote. And again, interjecting briefly before we continue with the article, he slipped out of the country last month, withdrawing his 4 children from school, terminating his lease, and obtaining visas for Saudi Arabia without attracting any attention from the police. Continuing, he is also a European Muslim convert, which might pose some concern to investigators. Quote, "The blonde-haired, blue-eyed al-Qaeda terrorist is an investigator's nightmare, because he does not fit the typical profile," Colonel Nick Pratt, a professor at the George C. Marshall European Center for Security Studies in Garmisch-Partenkirchen, Germany, said in an interview. Until recently, Mr. Ganscharski, who was unemployed, lived in Mülheim near the industry of the Ruhr Valley. As a child, he immigrated to Germany from Poland under laws providing for the return of ethnic Germans from Eastern Europe. By the way, the ethnic Germans living in Poland were called the Volksdeutsche, and one of the groups strongly affiliated with these German nationals in other countries are the Vertriebene groups that we've spoken about in RFA 37, among other programs. The Vertriebene groups have very strong links to what I call the Underground Reich and to elements of the SS and some of the more above-ground elements of the Underground Reich. Good discussion of that, by the way, in the recent book by Martin A. Lee called The Beast Reawakens. It would appear here that Goncharsky probably had connections with the Vertriebene milieu. Continuing. In the mid-1990s, Mr. Goncharsky converted to Islam. The police believe that he was recruited by Al-Qaeda in nearby Duisburg. The suspected recruiter, El Fatih Moussa Ali, also under investigation in connection with the Tunisian blast, left Germany for Sudan in May, according to the German weekly Der Spiegel. In the weeks following the bombing on Djerba, Mr. Goncharsky was questioned on a number of occasions. The German police had been monitoring him because he had been seen in the company of known extremists at a mosque in Duisburg. However, they say they did not realize the potential significance of the telephone call until after the bombing. Although Mr. Goncharsky admitted to having met Mr. Nawar while in Asia, he denied any connection to the plot, and the police who have released parts of the transcript say his involvement was impossible to prove. Quote, "Don't forget to remember me in your prayers," unquote, Mr. Nawar told Mr. Goncharsky, according to the transcript. "God willing," replied Mr. Goncharsky. "Do you need anything?" unquote. "No thanks," came the reply from Mr. Nawar. "I need your blessing." "God willing, okay," Mr. Goncharsky said. Shortly after the blast, Mr. Nawar had also called Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is widely believed to be one of the chief planners of the September 11th attacks. The deaths of the German tourists on Djerba prompted German legislators to revamp terrorist laws intended to combat domestic terrorism during the 1970s and 1980s. But Mr. Naim said he could not use new laws, which allow the prosecution of members of foreign terrorist organizations in Mr. Goncharsky's case, because they were passed after the Djerba attack and were not made retroactive. The failure to monitor Mr. Goncharsky occurred after he had confessed to the police that he had been in Afghanistan 5 times, and that he had met on occasion with Mr. Mohammed and once with Osama bin Laden. In their parallel investigation, the French police recently arrested a number of suspects, including Mr. Nawar's brother, Walid Nawar, in connection with the Djerba attack. They say Walid Nawar bought the satellite phone that Nizar Nawar used to call Germany and Pakistan. Before the Djerba attack, investigators say Nizar Nawar traveled to diverse parts of the world, including Afghanistan and Montreal. Investigators say an Al-Qaeda cell in Montreal led by Mobidu Ould Slahi conceived the failed 1999 plot to bomb Los Angeles International Airport. Mr. Slahi, reportedly related by marriage to Mr. bin Laden, and now in American custody at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, was often seen in the late 1990s with Mr. Goncharsky in Duisburg. Note here that Mr. Goncharsky, according to this report, had visited Afghanistan once about a month after the September 11th attacks. His recruiter, or the man described here as his recruiter, El Fatih Moussa Ali, also under investigation in connection with the Tunisian blast, left Germany for Sudan in May, and all of this without any interference by the German officials. One of the things that we spoke about in our conversations with Professor Stauffer, Professor Wilhelm Stauffer, a number of years ago, was that one of the goals of the Underground Reich is to portray Germany as a bastion of civil liberties, while the United States is portrayed as brutal and inhuman, et cetera, which is not to say that there is not plenty of brutality or inhumanity that has manifested itself through American actions over the decades. But this is a shocking thing. In light of the fact that the Hamburg cell that precipitated the attacks on September 11th, the fact that it was under physical surveillance by the Germans, and that they essentially took no activity is more than a little interesting and more than a little alarming. Note the Al-Qaeda and Muslim Brotherhood links, or the Al-Taqwa, excuse me, and Muslim Brotherhood links to the September 11th attacks, those closing the circle of the underground Reich in a more direct fashion. Again, bear in mind Al-Qaeda and the concept of the underground Reich as virtual states, as termed by Philip Bobbitt. I believe that they are strongly connected, and that another key element of that virtual state is the Bush administration. I believe we are facing subversion from within, coordinated with an attack from without, not unlike the position of France at the beginning of World War II. In keeping with some of the official Saudi connections to institutions connected to September 11th, we've spoken in the past, most recently in For the Record 389, about the International Relief Organization. That is connected to, among others, Yassin Al-Qadi, a prominent Saudi intern connected to the Al-Taqwa milieu, about which we've spoken so many times. The IRO was the focal point of an investigation a number of years ago, but that investigation was terminated, apparently due to the very important Saudi elements that were connected to the International Relief Organization. This is from the Wall Street Journal of December 16th of 2002. This is an article by Glenn R. Simpson of the Wall Street Journal. He's been doing some very good work about the investigation of the financial conduits behind September 11th, and you will see yet another reference here to the March 20th Operation Green Quest raids, about which I've spoken so many times. This article is headlined by the Wall Street Journal of December 16th of last year. U.S. had data on Virginia Group in terror probe as early as 1997. The article reads in part, newly available documents show federal investigators had extensive information as early as 1997 about possible fraud and money laundering at a Virginia-based Islamic charity under scrutiny for possible terrorist links. The information shows U.S. suspicions of financial irregularities at Muslim charities long predate the September 11th, 2001 terrorist hijackings, and that information sharing among federal investigators remains a significant hurdle, even as this line of pursuit has intensified since the attacks. The International Relief Organization of Alexandria, Virginia, had been the subject of a major probe of fraud, money laundering, and possible terrorism involvement launched in 1995 by the U.S. Attorney in Chicago. The case was an outgrowth of a sweeping federal inquiry into alleged terror cells in the Midwest during the mid-1990s, following intelligence reports of stepped-up organizing by groups there. Skipping down. The International Relief Organization came under investigation earlier this year, but officials had little information on the earlier case. Then, following a November report in the Wall Street Journal on the 1997 IRO probe, federal investigators sought the unsealing of testimony and evidence in the case. One Federal Bureau of Investigation affidavit offers new details on the previously undisclosed 1997 probe of the IRO, including evidence that much of the charity's funds were dispersed to its own officers for related entities or for vague purposes. Skipping down again, the Saudi embassy also was enmeshed in the IRO case. During the 1990s, the group received more than $400,000 through the embassy, Saudi officials confirm. U.S. officials now are investigating whether some of the IRO's funds went to groups or individuals suspected of having ties to terrorists. The prior probe ended without charges against IRO officials, but the group and related entities are at the center of a new, high-priority money laundering and terror investigation by federal prosecutors in Virginia. The group's offices in Alexandria were raided again in March by the Customs Service and the FBI. This, by the way, is a reference to the March 20th Operation Green Quest raids in the Virginia-Maryland Beltway area. Investigators want to know what happened to millions of dollars that passed through the group's bank accounts during the 1990s and remain unaccounted for. They also are interested in the group because it funded another Saudi-backed charity, Taiba International, that has been accused by the Bosnian government of involvement in terrorism. Skipping down again. It is difficult to imagine how a substantial organization such as the IRO could operate without maintaining any of the omitted records, unquote, FBI agent Valerie Donahue told a federal magistrate in an affidavit requesting a search warrant. Skipping down again. In addition to the IRO's backing from the Saudi embassy, some charity employees are believed to have held Saudi diplomatic passports. According to one Saudi official, the practice is common because many Saudi charities operate in war zones where workers need diplomatic status for protection. IRO officials were suspected of possible fraud and wire fraud and money laundering, the new unsealed affidavit by FBI agent Ms. Donahue says. And one more interesting item, the mid-90s probe failed because of the alleged Saudi failure to cooperate. The probe faltered after the group, which was sponsored by the Saudi government, allegedly failed to comply with a subpoena from federal prosecutors seeking information about its finances. No charges were ever brought, and for more than 5 years, details of the case have remained under seal in federal court. And yet another interesting Saudi link concerns a profile of an alleged Al-Qaeda terrorist who found cover working for firms that were headed up by the Al-Raji family. It is the Al-Raji family whose name was utilized for the SAR Foundation, one of the principal elements in the March 20th Operation Green Quest raids, about which we've spoken many times, and one of the organizations that overlaps not only the Islamo-Fascist Muslim Brotherhood, but the Islamo-fascist Al-Taqwa / Nada management milieu, which in turn brings the links to the Third Reich in its above-ground and underground phases full circle. And again, I think both Al-Qaeda and the underground Reich fit the definition of Philip Bobbitt's virtual state to a T. This is from the Wall Street Journal of Monday, December 30th of 2002, an article by Alan Cullison and Andrew Higgins. This is datelined Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and headlined, Al-Qaeda acolyte, one of many, vows to die for the cause. It reads in part, Faisal Al-Youssef, a 26-year-old computer programmer, had one small son and, by his own account, one big ambition, to slaughter infidels on behalf of Osama bin Laden. One of the ways he was able to move more toward the realization of his goal was by working for the very, very powerful and well-connected Al-Raji family. He had access to stolen documents, Mr. Youssef did, and skipping down, Mr. Youssef, the would-be Saudi kamikaze who volunteered for action after September 11th, has much the same profile as most of the hijackers. Young, well-educated, and well-traveled, according to his resume stored on the Kabul computer. He earned a degree in computer engineering and then, according to his resume, got a job as a programmer for the Al-Raji company and the Al-Raji real estate. Al-Raji is the name of a large and prominent business family in Saudi Arabia, one branch of which controls a big bank, the Al-Raji Banking and Investment Corporation. And it is the Al-Raji family whose name was lent to the SAR Foundation, which I believe stands for Suleiman al-Raji, or SAR for short. Another interesting dynamic to observe, and that will be possible repercussions of a recent Saudi reversal about allowing the United States to use bases in Saudi Arabia in the event of war with Iraq. They had previously said they would not. In For the Record 390, Political Plate Tectonics, I noted the movement in and around the December 6th resignation by Treasury Secretary O'Neill, whose departure, I believe, was caused less by the Bush administration's economic policies and more by the fact that he okayed the March 20th Green Quest raids, thereby threatening the deep political and deep economic relationships between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, which to a considerable extent empowered the September 11th attacks. Now, it'll be interesting to see if there is some kind of a quid pro quo, if the heat, so to speak, on the Saudi connections, and in particular the investigation of the March 20th raids, which would go, in addition to powerful Saudis, to the Republican Party and the milieu of the Bush administration. It'll be interesting to see if that investigation is attenuated in exchange for what might be a quid pro quo. The San Francisco Chronicle of Sunday, December 29th of 2002, has the following New York Times story by Eric Schmidt, Dateline Washington, headlined, Saudis to let U.S. use air facilities in Iraq war. It reads in part, Saudi Arabia has told American military officials that the kingdom would make its airspace, air bases, and an important operations center available to the United States in the event of war with Iraq, senior military officials say. Saudi Arabia was the main staging area for U.S. forces in the 1991 Persian Gulf War, but conflicting statements by top Saudi officials over the past several months have cast doubt on the Saudi support for military operations against Iraq this time around. U.S. commanders now say they have been given private assurances in recent weeks that they will be allowed to run an air war against Iraq from a sophisticated command center at Prince Sultan Air Base, the same command post that ran the air campaign in Afghanistan. It'll be interesting to see if the investigation of the powerful Saudi links to al-Qaeda is attenuated and whether that had something to do with Paul O'Neill's departure on December 6th. The last item that I will introduce, and this is another factor in the concept of the virtual state, which I have not discussed as much as in the past, and that is the links between al-Qaeda and also between what could be viewed as the underground Reich and elements of organized crime such as the international drug trade. This is from the Washington Post of Sunday, December 29th of 2002. This is by Douglas Farah of the Washington Post. Report says Africans harbored al-Qaeda terror assets hidden in gem buying spree. And this alludes to a complicated deal involving smuggled gems and the international weapons trade. In connection with the Iran-Contra affair, we took a look at weapons smuggling to, among others, the Contras. This went across ideological and national boundaries. It involved Israeli weapons dealers, among other things, weapons dealers in Bulgaria and behind what was then called the Iron Curtain, and all of this linking up with the Middle Eastern terrorist elements and the right-wing Nicaraguan army. Of this particular imbroglio, we read, European, U.S., and Central American officials have recently found evidence that Nasur and Osai of al-Qaeda were trying to buy weapons from the Nicaraguan army and a Bulgarian company. Investigators are trying to unravel whether that deal was meant to supply al-Qaeda with SA-8 surface-to-air missiles and sophisticated rockets. Documents obtained by the Post show that on January 2, 2001, an Israeli arms dealer in Panama named Simon Yelnik sent an email to a Russian arms merchant in Guatemala discussing an order that, quote, our friends in Africa need, unquote. Attached was a list of assault rifles, ammunition, and rocket-propelled grenades, as well as 20 SA-8 missiles and 200 rockets for BM-29 multiple rocket launchers. The weapons provider was to be the Nicaraguan army, the documents show. And again, one of the empowering aspects of the concept of the virtual state is the fact that money talks, and when you're talking about the international arms trade and elements of organized crime, it tends to transcend ideologies as well as the conventional nation state and market state. Sister station WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. Virtually the entire series is now available. More recent shows streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery, one word, DaveEmory. Older shows available for download only on Real Audio at a longer URL, link to the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website, and to the Real Audio equipped Spitfire website in the For the Record section. There'll be a detailed annotated article-length description of For the Record 393 in the Spitfire website, or on the Spitfire website, within a week of the airing of this show. Spitfire will send stations that wish to air the For the Record series CDs or tapes for free. Contact Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. This concludes For the Record 393, Love Means Never Having to Say You're Saudi, being recorded on January 5th of 2003. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.